The author, Will Self, has provided a dramatic image of the City of London's changing skyline. He likened it to a slow-motion firework display as new steel and glass skyscrapers rise and fall, sparkling for a few decades, but by implication at least, destined for ashes. It's easy to paint a depressing vision of the city, of any city. Quite apart from the aftershocks of the financial crisis, we could point to exploited workers, impersonal buildings, gated communities, shocking inequality, lonely lives. But I have not come here this evening to announce that we're all doomed. You can leave that to the politicians. City life, and especially the City of London, is often somehow considered to be apart from the rest of society. But the city, any city, is first and foremost where people live and work in all kind of families and industries. People make the city. It's not built around one area of business. And in this context, the question, what kind of city do we want, takes on a different hue. Can the city, any city, be a place of human flourishing? If so, what's required? These lines from T.S. Eliot's Chorus from the Rock point us in the right direction. When the stranger says, "What is the meaning of this city?" do you huddle close together because you love each other? What will you answer? We all dwell together to make money from each other. Or, this is a community. If the city is a community, then we all must pursue the things that cultivate community. But to do so means honoring a profound but often ignored truth about our humanity. Our relationships are an intrinsic part of who we are. As human beings, we're not just individuals. We're born into a human community and find our deepest fulfillment as persons in relationship to each other, and I would add, in relationship to God. This idea is central to the Judeo-Christian vision of humanity, created in the image and likeness of God, who in Christian revelation is seen to be a communion of persons. The ancient Greeks, too, had a clear view of the purpose of the city, the polis. It was to build a good society, a community where citizens thrived as members of a virtuous community. Aristotle explored this vision. He thought the cultivation of friendship, indeed love, were needed for there to be a good city. He also said, "The greatest blessing for a state is that its members should possess a moderate and adequate property." Now, this reference to property invites exploration of the specific ways in which cities' resources must serve everyone's good if the city is to have any sense of common destiny. Whatever the activity of the city might be, we're in it together. Like climbers tied together by invisible ropes, where the well-being and the fulfillment of each is in some way dependent on the others. There are ties of trust and solidarity to be recognized and consciously developed. The institutions of business and commerce, on which the reputation and the history of the City of London rest, have their foundation precisely in those common bonds. Indeed, there are many common goods that only come into being through trust and solidarity. In recent times, I would suggest, narratives about what makes for a good society have been viewed with suspicion. Rather, it's the hard-won individual freedom to pursue my own good in my own way within the law that is most celebrated. This mentality has legitimated the pursuit of narrow self-interest, sometimes with a tendentious claim that benefits will eventually yield better outcomes for everyone. It has made possible the atrophying of common values at the heart of good business and undermined institutions that stand between the market and the state, from the family to all kinds of community forms through which our relationships are indeed enriched and extended. However, in the aftermath of the financial crisis, we have a rare opportunity to learn from our recent past. The protest of the Occupy movement contained some searching questions about inequality, about the need to think hard together, about what can be changed for the good of all. How then can we nurture these relationships I'm speaking of? How can we even think about a destiny shared by all the people who work in the city, when the vast majority who work there come and go every day, whether high-paid professionals or those on low pay, providing the transport, the office cleaning, all the other services, whose lives seem totally disconnected from those with headline-making bonuses? Good people bound by good purpose. This is the phrase which I think points us towards an answer. Community is created and common destiny established through the vision, commitment, and relationships which good people form. But what do we mean by good? How is the notion of the good to be explored when we no longer share many of the patterns of thought which have helped to establish its meaning? Rather than cast morality only in terms of dull and boring duty, it can help us to understand desire as a more vital and fundamental driving force of morality. We yearn for love, for relationships of deep friendship, for our lives to have meaning, and to make a contribution. Far from being an externally imposed duty on us, this desire for the good lies deep within us. It reflects our deepest nature as sharing a common humanity and as called into a life of relationships with others. This desire and this call invite us to recognize that the other people matter, and respecting others and seeking their good is essential to my own good. Seeking the good, responding to its attractiveness, takes us out of a narrow self-centeredness. It is the path to true human flourishing and development. The truth is, we are all secretly tempted to do good. But the complementary and inconvenient truth is that our desire for the good can easily be distorted through selfishness, greed, pride, or lust. Thus, this is the struggle between good and evil that runs right through each of us in every aspect of our lives. We don't like to think in those terms, but we all operate in a moral space, discerning and testing our desires, deciding how to live. And we're caught between, on the one hand, the attractiveness of a good we suspect may not only be transitory, but also carry with it damaging consequences for others, and on the other hand, our capacity and desire for real, extraordinary generosity and selflessness. To learn to live well on this understanding is to learn to practice the virtues, which are both rooted in our dignity and gradually shape our character as persons. By the pursuit of virtue, we act well, not because of external constraint, but because it has become habitual for us to do so. The virtues form us as moral agents, so that we do what is right and honourable, irrespective of reward and regardless of obligation. Now, the classical, pivotal, or cardinal virtues are prudence, justice, courage, and temperament. Permit me a quick glance at each one. They belong to all humanity. They're held in trust, not least in our Christian tradition. Their relevance to good people bound by good purpose is clear. The virtue of prudence, right reason in action, is the opposite of rashness and carelessness. It enables us to discern the good in any circumstance and the right way of achieving it. It enables us to know how to weigh the meaning and the importance of our feelings. The virtue of courage ensures firmness and a readiness to stand by what we believe in times of difficulty. It is the opposite of opportunism or evasiveness. It is the practice of this courage or fortitude in the face of difficulty that produces heroism in every field. Courage is a crucial element in artistic creativity, and it helps those who battle against sickness, injustice, or depression. Justice is the virtue by which we strive to give what is due to others by respecting their rights and fulfilling our duties towards them. Justice then expands our sense of self by strengthening the ties between us. Justice towards God is the virtue of religion, and that frees us from the tyranny of false gods who so easily claim our worship. The virtue of temperance helps us to moderate our appetites and our use of the world's created goods. It's the opposite of consumerism and the uninhibited pursuit of pleasure. Temperance is about learning to desire well. Indeed, it's an essential part of a happy life. Now, the formation of good people, the formation of people of virtue, starts in the family. That's the first school of citizenship. And living stable families are a vital building block of every city. Schools, of course, are the next most important institution, as are universities, and in the context of the city, the business schools. Whilst we should look to these institutions to foster virtue and thereby build character, we can and should also look to the institutions of commerce to nurture and strengthen this same character. If this is to happen, then such institutions will have to have a clear sense of purpose, shared across the institution, and evidently focused on a wider common good. They will be enterprises of good purpose. Now, the review of Staffordshire NHS Trust, where the staff, people, good people in the main, were led by a catalogue of failings to collude in catastrophic failure. In that review, the head of the Professional Standards Authority spoke of leaders having lost sight of their moral purpose. They had forgotten they exist to do good. Concern for finance had taken priority over care, compassion, and respect. He said, unless you know the purpose for which you are running an organization, you will never get the ethics right within it. But let's be clear, such a sense of good purpose is not just for the public sector, but also for commercial organizations. Mark Carney, the incoming governor of the Bank of England, spoke recently of the need for companies, and I quote, to define clearly the purpose of their organization and promote a culture of ethical business. And in doing so, for employees to have a broader sense of purpose, grounded in strong connections to their clients and to their communities. We've seen what happens when business or people simply focus on profit as an end in itself and exploit every situation for that end. The true justification of business, I suggest, is when profit is made through delivering a purpose that genuinely adds to human well-being. Business, every business, has an implicit license to operate given by society. In my view, then, businesses, big or small, should be able to demonstrate how they are making the world a better place through providing goods that are truly good and services that truly serve people. And by doing so, create employment and fair returns to investors and minimize harm. Now, any business that wants to stay true to that purpose needs people who not only have the technical skills, but also the character and the virtues of which I have been speaking. Such people become indispensable to the long-term flourishing of the business. Of course, in the short term, greed and ambition can triumph. It always has and will. Out-of-control bonuses were one of the symptoms. But the architects of lasting business success learn to understand and control their own self-interest and genuinely combine it with seeking to serve society through the way their business operates. By acting consistently, doing what they say, setting and acting on high expectations, they create a culture within the organization that strengthens good practice. A business that has a compelling story about its purpose, that lives its values, in this way will crowd in and not crowd out virtue. It will attract, nurture, and reward good people. It will inspire the good in people and help create the common bonds that serve to reduce inequality by providing opportunities and operating in every aspect of its work in a fair and equitable way. Part of the interest in business, in the exploration of good people bound by good purpose, has come from the recognition of the limits of law and regulation. Of course, law and regulation matter, but they're not sufficient. New rules normally deal with the last problem, not the next one. A compliance mentality typically creates perverse incentives and increases bureaucracy. Rules become a lazy proxy for morality. People think if it's not against some rule, then it's okay. And such a society is inherently fragile. What is required, beyond even ethical standards of conduct, is a fundamental transformation of purpose so that business, maybe the financial sector in particular, is seen by everyone as it should be at the service of the rest of society. A change of language, a change of mission statement is not enough. And the risk of language changing without credible reform is still real. I'm not surprised that commentators such as John Kay say that it will take another financial crisis before the city really wakes up to the scale of reform that is needed. I believe that there's great potential for good in people which far too many employers do not realize or encourage. It is surely bad for business if people feel they have to leave their values at the door when they go to work. It's a mistake if companies have to justify themselves through their additional programs of social benefit or through the philanthropy of their staff. These are good, of course, but they should be supplementary to the shared value created by the core work of the business activity. The vocation to work in business is a good for people and society, but it depends on business having a clear purpose to serve that society. Often, the quality of leadership is crucial. The struggle to maintain the positive purpose of a business or institution is challenging. The temptations of shortcuts, of ignoring or marginalizing uncomfortable questions. These temptations are real and powerful, especially for those in leadership roles. I know. But I also recall a very profound point about leadership made by Vaclav Havel. He said that a key moral choice which leaders often have to make concerns what they appeal to in others. As a leader, do they appeal to the fear in other people? Do they appeal to the greed in other people? Or do they appeal to their selflessness and their desire for a wider good? Business, the media, wider society, in short, our culture, is hugely influenced by these choices made by leaders in all walks of life. They contribute significantly to the background expectation within which we all make our choices. Being reminded regularly of our wider purpose can prevent us from slipping from those moorings. Having routines which reinforce all that is best in us. For many, the practice of prayer each day is a fine example. Having those routines helps us to remember a good business is a community as well as an organization. It produces people as well as goods and services, and it contributes to the formation or the undermining of society by the way people are treated. As the chief executive of Unilever, Paul Polman, reminded us at the launch of a conference, A Blueprint for Better Business, last September, he said, in the long term, no business can succeed in a society that is failing. The city that we want has many other dimensions to it of which I have not spoken. Reduced income inequality, a living wage, the need for much more support of family life in the built environment, a welcome for new communities, efforts to overcome barriers. In many ways, London is a remarkable example of tolerance and vibrant city life. And these are all aspects of community life that are deeply connected to how business operates. The Christian instinct, at its best, is to see the potential for good in the city. It's interesting to note that the Bible starts in a garden and ends in a city, even if it is not the square mile that the evangelist had in mind. And this beautiful cathedral provides a stunning symbol of the vision of the heavenly city in the midst of the earthly one. It invites us both to gaze upwards and place our hopes and fears in the context of the eternal, yet also its spectacular size and beauty at the same time invites us to our knees, to recognize our frailty, our need of one another, and our shared destiny. Humanity has the most extraordinary capacity for good, and I deeply believe that there are great wellsprings of renewal for this city, for every city, in untapped ways of how we organize the world of work at the service of the common good. And I thank you for your attention.